We've talked before, see episode 2, about how the internet affects society.
But how does it affect you, dear listener, or us?
How did the effects change for the vast majority of people who remember a time without the internet, and those who don't?
The negative side effects might seem somewhat sinister.
Who's the culprit?
The answer might surprise you this week.
Philosophers. Okay, David. So, a little off the cuff with this one this week.
Yeah.
But I think that's okay. Back to porn. So, I've been thinking about the internet a lot lately.
Okay.
Part of it has to do with some media that I've consumed lately, ironically enough, on the internet.
Is that ironic?
No, people misuse that word all the time.
And you just did too.
And I'm a people, so, yeah. Specifically, I'm going to go and cite it. I'm not going to make a recommendation either way on it, to be honest. I just want to say that this is what made me think about it. There was a YouTube video, that was a promotional video for a Netflix special. So there's the chain of events. The internet video is called Welcome to the Internet, from the Netflix special Inside by Bo Burnham. Veterans of the net will know who that is, I think.
A comedian,
yes. A YouTube comedian from the 10s. And I think he's even a little bit before. I think he's like an 08 as when he started, back in the early days of YouTube. But he has thus since gone on to doing real comedianing in the real world. Comedy. But the subject matter of this comedy special, they're the three overarching, I guess, themes throughout it are, one of them has to do with his mental health and mental health in general. The other one the second has to do with the concept of perfectionism and how he just discusses that concept. And then the third one is the internet. The first two seem like they kind of go together, but then the internet is like, where does that one come from? Well, Bo is in his early 30s, and this is important when talking about the internet, because we are in a great time right now to talk about the internet being that most people that are alive, I would argue, remember a time before the internet,
or at least before the widespread use of the internet.
Right. The internet
has... You may have been born after the internet was created, but that was still a long time before everyone had internet service at home.
Right. The internet as it is accessible today, I would say, in circa 2021. Sure. Colorized.
Or especially the web.
Yes, that's more aptly, I think, what we're talking about. But if you were to say web, even the web is an older school way of referring to it, but that I don't hear used in common parlance. I don't hear anyone say, I got on the web, but...
I'll avoid my rant about people not knowing the difference between the internet
and
the web.
You can actually go ahead and do that. Sure, give me the condensed version of the rant.
Okay, for those who may not be familiar with the distinction between the internet and the web, the internet is the giant network of computers that allows you to communicate with others throughout the world. And you can do this through various different protocols, is the technical term. So, like, one of the oldest internet protocols would have been internet relay chat. What's the simplest thing you can think to do with a giant network like the internet? Talk to each other through text chat. So that's where IRC came from. I'm not going to go through a history of internet protocols. That's not really the topic.
See a different episode about that. I'm just kidding.
Can we do one about that? Yeah. No.
I don't think we will.
Anyway, email is another internet protocol that is still used widely today. Email is not the web. It still uses the internet as its medium to carry the messages from person to person, but it's its own protocol. It uses a few different protocols to make the system of email. The web was invented in the 90s by a researcher at CERN who wanted to make a better way to link documents to one another. So he invented the concept of hypertext, which is text that refers to other text. This is where links come from. Hyperlinks link to other documents. And so the intention of the web was so that you could read an article about something or a paper, and if it made a mention of some other paper, you could just click its name and then be taken to that paper to see it. And it's called the web, or well, it was originally called the World Wide Web. Hence WWW, that's where that comes from.
Right.
Or like the W3C, the World Wide Web Consortium. Anyway, the web is called that because if you think about the actual structure of this, where you can have documents that they don't link just in one way, they can refer back and forth to one another. And so if you think about it visually, if you were to draw, you know, like a point or a circle for every page, and then draw a line to every other page that it links to, or that links to it, then it resembles a spider web.
Right. And that's what most people say when they say the internet. That's what they mean when they say the internet these days. Like,
yes, it just so happened that the web was good for a lot more than just linking research papers and documents to one another. You could use this to make all kinds of other stuff. Right. And so the ubiquity of web browsers, because people, you know, browsers were made to be able to look at these documents.
Crawl on the web, if you will.
Or then later surf the web, because yes, we got to be cool. Anyway.
Cowabunga. Sorry.
Anyway, everyone has a web. Everyone at some point who had a computer and had an internet connection had a web browser for doing stuff like that. So then what happens in the software world is whenever everyone has something, developers start to target it. Because if you want a bunch of people to use your thing, make it run on something everyone already has.
Right.
This is just a good strategy for getting lots of users, which usually means more money.
Right.
So with more things being built for the web, most people's only exposure to the internet was through the web.
Right.
And so then the terms became basically interchangeable in the vernacular, where now most people don't know the difference between the internet and the web, even though you do use other internet things that aren't the web.
Right.
I already mentioned email, although most people now access their email account on the web. So that further blurs that line. But technically, the underlying system that gets email messages from one place to another is not using the web.
Right. And I think the only thing nowadays that's keeping the term internet as it is formally described alive, beyond just the technical maintainers of the internet, right? They will understand the difference because it's their niche. And they will use that term in its technical definition. But the only other common parlance term is the IoT acronym.
Because IoT is not going to be using the web.
Right.
Right. And most any automated thing you use that uses the internet is not using the web. So, you know, if you have a, let's see, I don't know, if you're one of the folks who is getting on the smart speaker bandwagon, then that is not using the web necessarily to get its results for your queries. It's right. Using some other thing to talk to whatever server it's doing.
Right.
Although maybe it is implemented by way of the web, but that's not really important. Or like, okay, if your phone or computer has support for automated software updates, which most anything does, that's not using the web. It's using some other type of connection to figure that out.
Right. So that tangent aside,
yeah,
that's all to explain that when I'm saying internet and the way it's
used, we're talking about the web today because this is what most people use to interface with the internet.
Yeah. Right. And I probably am not going, I'm going to be a bad host today, and I'm going to continue to use the terms interchangeably for common parlance sake, but
I will judge you quietly.
You may. And we have at least made the distinction that at least you know the difference. So what I was more interested in are the, and we've kind of talked about this before, the more social and downstream consequence of human internet, or in this case, human web interaction. I know what's done. We've talked about like privacy before, in relation to the internet. That was like one of the earliest videos we did, One of our most popular ones, actually. But having watched this special, particularly the promo video, which kind of highlights that section and really begins that, there are a couple of things that I really felt like we needed to address. So I'm gonna start off with like kind of how what has been the meta discussion about this, and then kind of go from there and then draw our own conclusions, I think, a little bit. So in the tune, because Bo also does a lot of his comedy through music, he writes and performs songs to help him deliver his comedy routine. So the song, it's actually a song called Welcome to the Internet, where he personifies the internet, or the web, more accurately, I guess.
But sure, he's calling it the internet, that's
yeah.
fine.
Yeah, and it's like a carnival, what's the part, like the ringleader at the carnival, or maybe the person at the front of the carnival, at a carnival, who's like, welcome inside, we have, and he's yeah. like trying to sell it to you, like, we have all these things, and then there's some comedy bits about the variety, where he'll swing from a more academic topic to a ridiculous topic, you know what I mean, or like a fetishized topic or something like that, and mm-hmm. juxtaposing the two things is funny because you don't expect them to be discussed side by side.
Right, he's getting at the interesting property of the internet, that because it has basically everything you would want to know about on it, or whatever, that you can get from very innocuous things like pictures of cats to whatever.
Yeah, to very lewd material.
Right.
Very quickly.
And so, yeah, he's juxtaposing the innocuous with the explicit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. And somewhat in a 6 degrees separation type way, where, if you're not familiar with that, and I'm sure this is not the original usage of the term 6 degrees separation, but the Wikipedia speedrun game, where only using links, get from any article to an article about Adolf Hitler,
yep.
for example.
I've played this game.
And
it's surprisingly easy.
Right. And that's funny, because being the web, and I think this is why actually your explanation of why it's called the web, and a little bit about
Wikipedia
hypertext,
is a great example of the thing that the web was designed to do.
Right. But the interesting consequence is that the web can kind of help show links between things that in your mind would not be linked together normally. Because our brains kind of function a little bit like a web too, in the way that we form associations to things. But we form them linearly with our perception or experience, right? I will, like, anything that I witness in the same area together at the same time, I will form an association. Or if I'm listening to a certain song while an event happens, I will associate them, because there's a memory that I'm using to associate the two things. So on and so forth. Whereas with the web, it's a lot more clinical. It's, oh, well, you know, these two things are linked because, like, if you look up a company, it's like, this is a company. This company has headquartered in Germany. Germany had a previous yeah. government. That previous government was ran by Adolf Hitler. Like,
right. Or I was thinking, like, what two things might I propose that are completely opposite? We have Adolf Hitler, which is the goal of the game to get to.
Right.
Puppies. Or dogs would be the correct Wikipedia article. Okay. Dogs. German Shepherd. German. Nazi Germany. Hitler.
There you go. Yeah. And it's funny to us because of how quickly that took that turn, right? It subverts our expectation that way. Because most of our experiences with dogs are not with also Nazi Germany.
Right. Or even when you see that specific breed, when you see a German Shepherd, you're not thinking of the Nazis.
No,
right?
You're thinking about all the other times you've personally seen a German Shepherd, which to some people might be terrifying if you've ever been around a vicious one.
Sure, everyone has different experiences with dogs, but yeah.
Right. The internet does not have a personality in that way. It did not experience any of these things. But what's interesting is people that did link these things together. And even in the internet, there are some biased paths for how things are associated based on what the most common experience is. whether it be factual or not, but that's a subject for another time. I don't necessarily want to go down that rabbit hole because I'm not going to talk about whether or not the internet has a personality or the web has a personality. But in this clip, he goes through all of the funny different things you can juxtapose that you can all get from the internet, or the web. But he takes an abrupt stop to this to talk about the internet as he remembered it, which I think is a very common story that a lot of people who are alive today will have that will not exist in the next couple of generations. And that is that most of the human beings alive today have memories of a time before they had the internet. Be it because the internet had not arrived in your area yet, or the internet as we might know it today arrived in your area yet.
Right. Like when I was little, we had internet service at my house for a long time. I don't know that we always had it, but I was very young when we got it. But the web had not been populated with nearly as many things as it is now. And it also wasn't very widely known, at least among the people that I knew at the time, how to readily find things on the internet. And like search engines were still kind of the new thing.
And they were competing, actually.
Right. Like Google didn't exist.
No. Alphabet did, maybe.
Sure, I don't know the history of Alphabet. But
the parent company of Google.
Yeah, Alphabet is the parent company that owns Google. But anyway. Yeah, I don't know what they were up to at the time. But anyway, Google didn't exist. There were other search engines, but people didn't really, most people did not know how to use them effectively. Right. Like I remember when I was in school, pretty early in school, but one of the things that we were taught when we started going to the computer lab is how to use a search engine, how to find things that you're looking for.
How to query using a search engine more
right.
specifically.
Yes.
And to be fair, I don't even think that it's people didn't know how to use search engines as well, because that's part of it, but search engines didn't do what they do today.
That's true. They were very simple.
Yes, they actually just looked through the registry of pages they had for the words you typed in the way you typed them. So, for example, if you wanted to see baking sheets, it would take the spaces between the words and do a search for baking and do a search for sheets and then also for baking sheets. But if you wanted to force it to look for baking space sheets, you could put quotes around it, for yep. example. If you wanted to look for baking and sheets, you could do baking plus sheets, which is what most search engines will just do now. If you put the words together like that and just leave the space with nothing else, it will add a plus sign. And you can see this actually if you use a search engine. If you look in the
look
URL
in the
address
bar. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you could do minuses, baking minus sheets. I want to see about baking, but
everything
don't...
baking that doesn't mention sheets. Yeah.
Yeah. exactly. So search engines gave you the ability to kind of chop that up, but modern search engines do suggestions now as well.
Well, yeah, yeah. There was suggestions have been around for a little bit longer than search engines have been doing that, but yeah, the goal of search engines now, the folks who are developing search engines, is to make language interpreters out of the search bar.
Well,
they want to know, like, okay, I see the words you typed, but what are you actually looking for? Like, it's trying to remove the query syntax from
right.
the search engine. So, which, slight tangent, annoys me because I do know how to query a search engine properly, but now, this is especially bad with Google. Other search engines aren't quite this bad, but Google is trying so hard to be a language interpreter that when I try to be very specific about what I want, it thinks it knows better than me about what my query is
right.
and gives me whatever most people are looking for when they look for words like it.
Right. Well, and not only that, but it's trying to interpret your speech, not just on how most people talk, but with the use of cookies, what you mean specifically. What have you looked for in the past? What are your browsing habits? What are things that, where are websites you've been before? Why did you ask me this? And see if it can figure that out to better give you what you think you want or what it thinks you think you want.
Yeah.
And that is also kind of a big difference. And I think a good way that you can kind of highlight this is something that I think will change in the coming generations. people do not talk into search engines the way we talk to each other. And the great way to do that is to start typing like a query, like how Google has autocomplete searches. So when I'm describing something to Google, like say I don't remember a character from a show and I don't even remember his name or anything, but I can say guy with black hair on show. I say it guy with or man with black hair on that 70s show. Like say that's the TV show. I would never describe that person to you that way. I would change that up to be more understandable, but I don't do that for the search engine because I'm like, it has,
you know,
much
you're
extra,
talking to a machine.
Yeah, it has extra words. I know in my head that I'm giving it keywords, but I think the better Google gets at trying to interpret, I would imagine in a few generations people will actually just use the microphone to say to Google how they would describe it to a person.
A funny anecdote, this is very short, but I had an experience recently where someone was just getting used to the digital assistant that came with their phone's operating system. And so they wanted to search for something really specific. And he hit the button to ask and just asked it like he would a person. And it came back with complete nonsense because he was so specific about it. Because it was such an obscure thing. But he just explained the concept of the computer. And I'm like, we're not there yet.
But we want it to be there. And that's, yeah. That's, I think.
But most of the time, it's close enough. Like, sometimes I'm surprised by how well the digital assistant can do with stuff like that.
Right.
This time happened about as well as I expected it to. But.
Right. But that's because it's still not there yet. And I also can't help but think that those of us who are using, the vast majority of us using the internet today anyway, we can separate it. We understand that Google is not a person. I'm not saying that younger generations are stupid and think that it is a person by any means, but we've been taught to treat it differently, right? Like we have learned that this is, you know, like going all the way back to algorithmic searching, you know, or, you know, specific queried structured speech. We understand keywords and how they work. And if you are any level of technically inclined, you can even start using query speech, all caps ands, all caps ors, all caps nots, to kind of help you funnel and query, you know, funnel your query down. Mm-hmm. And it understands. But the reason this is interesting to me is that we will never, I think, live in a time like this again. Like humanity will only be at the point where it invents the internet once. That this is not one of those inventions we're going to dark age, I don't think. We will never go back to Web 1 or Web 2.0, right? And that's a higher concept.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about that.
We won't talk about that. If you're curious about what I'm talking about, look up Web 1.0, Web 2.0, and Web 3.0. You will get back some interesting stuff. But more keenly, referencing back to the original material, he talks about how when he was in circa 99 is what he uses, which I'm pretty sure was just for artistic decisions. Pre 9/11, pre all this, the internet was a lot more sparse. Most of the content that existed on the internet that was created by an individual, not a company, was there because the person was interested in the thing. They did not necessarily go seeking an audience. They weren't necessarily trying to fill a demand. They were trying to...
Right, because... Yeah, one of the other differences is that web platforms didn't really exist back then. If you wanted to put something on the web, you had to make your own website.
Right.
You had stuff like GeoCities, which was sort of a platform, but really that was more of a host. You weren't trying to get points like you do on modern web platforms. Like,
right.
Like if you post something on YouTube, you're there for views or likes or whatever thing.
You can get paid, yeah.
Yeah, or you can get paid. That kind of, like, that didn't really exist. Advertising existed, but whatever. But, yeah, you had to put forth effort to do that. And this was also back in the day. Remember the favorites menu? When's the last time you used that? Well, now it's called bookmarks. They changed the name.
Right. Or favorites bar. It's still referred to that on the Microsoft Edge browser.
Okay.
Which I use because... You know, don't at me.
Please send hate mail too. anyway, yeah. So favorites / bookmarks, like this was a time when you needed to use that because you had to go directly to websites you wanted to go to. Because again, search engines were not very good. If you found something, you may be lucky to have found it and you need to remember where it was.
I think a good comparison is just go on Reddit and find something and then try to find it a week later without saving it. Like, actually kind of how the internet used to be. It's a good microcosm.
Although for different reasons.
But the experience is oddly similar. And even some of the first platforms, like MySpace, for example, it was similar. Like, OG MySpace was, here's a template WordPress website, kind of. But you kind of have to make this your own. Like, I'm not going to give you an about section that's easy to navigate. I'm not going to, you know, you really have to build your own website inside of a shell. But I'm going to make it easier than, you know, well, TM, than it would have been, you know.
It doesn't require the technical knowledge.
No, and even things like PHP came about in this time. Personal homepage, which is a software language for building primarily websites.
Yeah, websites with a little bit more power than standard HTML and CSS and JavaScript. Yeah.
Right. Came about to fill this demand for, I need to make a website now as an individual. PHP supposedly tried to fill the niche of making these. I'm personally biased against PHP, so I'm not going to give a good adequate
explanation. Well, yeah, you know that PHP stands for Programmers Hate PHP.
I was going to say it stands for Personal Help Page, but like...
I like mine better.
Yeah, either way. So it was different. And then there's a line in the song that he says... again, remember, he's trying to personify the internet. He says... and it's also in the context of... Mommy gave you her iPad and you were barely two, and it did all the things we designed it to do. We being the people behind the internet. So the interesting thing about the song is he uses the phrase we in three different ways. And that's the quote genius of the song, is that we means the internet. We also means the people behind the internet that make the internet now. And we also means you and the internet, us.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. I've watched a couple of video essays about it thus far where people really dig in and say, what does he mean by we here? Which is great. If people are debating your usage of a single word like we, you probably did a pretty decent job if there's any open-ended question about it or interpretation. But it takes this tone that the internet, as it is today, was created by an evil entity that wanted to give you everything and get you hooked like a drug. And then the next line of the song is, we can do, it's like, if we stick together, just imagine what we could do. Again, using that we very tactically. And then he starts maniacally laughing, and then it goes back to the chorus tagline of the song, which is, how about a little bit of everything all of the time? A little bit of everything all the time. And that's how the song ends, is him. It has this playful carnival tune, but like with the more evil subtext.
Yeah, there's a sinister subtext. Yeah.
Exactly. So what's interesting about it is I'm not going to try to assume his motives, right? Because I think that's the genius about it. And it's
poetry. This is how poetry works.
Yeah, it stands on its own.
It's to be interpreted by the reader or listener, as it were.
Yeah, but the work itself, not what the author intended, like, necessarily.
Right. You get, like, yeah, the thing about art, you can get your own meaning out of it, even if it's not what the author intended.
Right. And I think this was created specifically to not show his personal intention. It was to allow you to think about it for yourself.
Yeah. Consider the implications. Yeah.
For you, because he uses we. Like, and when he says we, and he's personifying something else, he's really trying to get you to figure out how you fit in we, or do you fit in we?
You know? What's your place in this whole situation? Yeah.
Right. So the first pass listen, and what a lot of people have taken from this thus far, is that we means the evil people behind the internet. Because as soon as a sinister connotation comes into effect, everyone starts, a lot of the commentary is, yeah, the internet is like that. The internet's addictive. It's a commodity. It's a commodification of whatever, trying to sell products and everything. And it's the evil corporate. All of a sudden there has to be a bad guy, right? Because evil things have to have a sinister mastermind. It's simpler that way when there's always a bad guy we can defeat.
Yep.
But if you listen to it again, we means us, all of us, because that's the thing about the internet.
Right. Yeah. There's not an evil group, like mastermind behind all this. This is the internet. The problems that we face because of the internet are things we have done to ourselves.
As humanity. Like,
right.
The internet, what makes it, particularly the web, again, what makes it so interesting is that it is an amalgamation of, it's the closest thing to what those in woo-woo culture would describe as a collective conscious. It's not.
Yeah.
It's the output, though, of all of our consciousnesses trying to make stuff for it.
It's a reflection of ourselves.
Yes.
I'll paraphrase from CGP Grey, who we mention in almost every episode.
Because he's great.
Because he's gray. Sorry.
Gray.
He had a video about Reddit. And he says, you know, you might be tempted to say Reddit is weird. Well, Reddit is weird, but only because people are weird.
Yeah.
Reddit is a reflection of the people who use it, which covers almost everybody, almost every demographic.
Right.
And so the internet is just that, but even bigger. The internet is a reflection of ourselves. If you look at the internet and say, wow, that's weird, it's because people are weird.
Yep. And what's even funnier about that weirdness is that if you found it, you were probably looking for it. So who's really weird? The person that put it there, or the fact that you know it exists now because you went looking for it?
Yeah, you went looking for it, yeah.
Right. And you can find an odd kinship that way through the internet by stumbling upon some weird stuff, you know. Stumbling, if you will. It actually reminds me of a web page. I'm going to push that topic for a minute. But that's the funny thing about it is if you've searched for anything on the internet and it's answered, that's because someone searched for it before you. And at some point long ago, maybe not that long ago, someone searched for it and they didn't get what they wanted.
So they made it
so that people like you who are like them, when they search for it,
would find it.
Yeah. That's... think about that. So you are we are us. Toys are us. But that's the thing about the internet is there is no villain. Don't be wrong, that's not to say that there aren't people who may be wanting to do sinister things on the internet, but they're people, not the masters of the whole internet. There is no real monopoly like that on the internet.
No,
at least not yet. Not to say that people haven't tried, but it is one of the best reflections of us as humanity. And we had talked a little bit about it when we were discussing whether we wanted to do this as a subject. But humans have this strange habit of optimizing. We were discussing Mesa optimizers, which we don't necessarily need to go into what that is. Maybe.
No, we're not going to talk great length about Mesa optimizers, but this is a concept in... artificial intelligence safety research. The gist of how we're going to talk about this and why it's relevant is if you're trying to engineer an AI system, then you may like the challenge of AI, like we have software already that creates optimizers. And so an optimizer is just something that if you give it a goal, then it can figure out how to maximize that goal. You know, if you give it enough time and resources, it can figure out the best way to maximize whatever thing you told it to do.
A good example is, I need you to make as many postcards as possible.
Yeah.
Given these inputs, it will find a way to use those inputs to achieve that goal to the best of its ability.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The classic AI safety example is the stamp collector bot.
Right.
Where if you give it full access to the internet, then eventually it will just turn the entire world into stamps because it figured out how to do that.
Because that's the way to collect the most stamps
is to turn everything into stamps.
Right.
Right. So we're not going to talk too much about AI safety here, but the relevance of Mesa optimizers is when you try to sidestep this problem. The problem with the stamp collector bot destroying the world is called the alignment problem, which is where the optimizer's goals do not perfectly align with what goal you actually had. You gave it a goal thinking that that goal accurately represented the actual goal that you wanted it to achieve, but it found a way to do something that you didn't expect, which is turn the whole world into stamps. Like, you thought it was going to get a lot of stamps, but in fact it killed you and turned you into stamps.
Because that's how you get more stamps.
Because it can get more stamps. So you have an alignment problem. So one way, and it turns out to be okay, it's not the most naive way, but a naive way to do this is to create an optimizer for the optimizer, a meta optimizer. And the opposite of meta is mesa. So you have the end AI system that's being optimized by the meta optimizer is called the mesa optimizer. And now I'm real deep into the terms now.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to try to get away from the technical language because it's not important. The important thing about this is that this ends up creating just another alignment problem where the optimizer who's trying to train the end result AI is also coming up with goals, and it may come up with goals that are effective right now at getting the final AI system to do what you want, but the MESA optimizer, the final result, is it has ideas of its own. You know, if you, I'm trying to do this without getting too deep into technical details of examples, but I'll just use this because this is the thing we're actually talking about, and it is sort of an example that the guy that I learned this from used, which is, suppose, consider human psychology.
Okay.
Imagine that you're a deity and you're designing human psychology, and you want to give humans the goal of survival and reproduction,
okay,
which is the apparent goal of life.
Right.
So a way that you might go about doing, like, you could meticulously program exact behaviors that you want. But if you program exact behaviors that you want, then when edge cases arise, you may get behavior you don't want.
Sure. Pandas. But go on.
We don't need to talk about pandas.
No.
So you need something more general. So how are you going to do this? Well, you can create a reward system where any behavior that the humans do that is likely that makes them more likely to succeed in reproduction and survival makes them feel good. This works for basically all life forms as we know them, at least that have brains. But humans are in an interesting position because they are intelligent enough to change their environment in meaningful ways. So the example that we had talked about briefly before the show was food that we like.
Right.
It would be advantageous as a designer to say, okay, things that are rich in nutrients should taste good. So like fruits, sugary things. These are very valuable because they're calorie dense. They don't take a lot of work to get, and they will help you survive longer for less input energy.
Right.
So the problem is that humans figured out how to farm. So you took something that was very sparse in nature. There's not just an overwhelming supply of it. It's still good. And you create a farm out of it where now there's an abundance. You can have as much as you want to the point where you fatten yourself and contract things like diabetes and these other things that hurt you. As the designer, you'll be disappointed by this result that you thought you came up with a clever optimization. Okay, we can just make nutrient-rich things taste good, except that those nutrient-rich things must be taken in moderation, but you didn't program in moderation.
Right.
You know, so they'll just eat all kinds of sugary things until they get sick. And then maybe they'll stop.
Probably not.
Maybe. So that's the MESA optimizer problem, is that you come up with a way to codify the goal.
under a certain certain set of circumstances, but the problem arises when the entity that you're training changes the circumstance.
You, the mistake you made, and really this isn't the Mesa Optimizer problem, this is the alignment problem, but yeah, you thought you correctly codified the goal, but you didn't. The agent, humans in this case, the agent, its only goal is to maximize the reward.
Right.
So it will do whatever it takes to get more of that reward. It'll eat things that taste good to its own detriment, because they taste good. It's not consider it. Its goal is to feel pleasure. Its goal is not to be healthy.
Right. And that's ultimately, you know, in human psychology, the reward function for us is endorphins a lot of the time.
Endorphins, dopamine.
Dopamine, yeah. We have chemical reward systems built into our brain that are designed to give us... Designed, yes. Designed by evolution, by the way. Not designed, but, like, they evolved, I guess.
Right, yeah. They're not designed, but sure. They emerged, yeah.
They emerged to say... Not to say, but to give us a motivation to do anything. The vast majority of things that you do, you will do them because they feel good, or because you're a thinking person. You might also be able to realize that you might feel good later if you do them, and you can actually also...
Yeah, you're willing to delay gratification if the reward is going to be greater by delaying it.
Right.
Yeah.
Mix that with fear, and you have both sides of the spectrum. You have rewards, and you have carrots and sticks, if you will.
Yes.
Chemically speaking, in your head, things that will... influence your brain to make decisions for to get carrots, yes, and to run
you
away
seek pleasure and avoid pain,
right? So in everything that we do, it's in the context of this carrot and stick system. The internet was no exception. The difference is being totally artificial and limitless, because a lot of all of the web is really just information. It's just content. Right? That's the word.
Yeah, that's
that
the
use.
Fancy word everyone wants to use now.
Content, yes.
I hate that word.
And
but
you engage with content.
Or consume content.
Consume it,
and
yes.
Do not infringe my content. Anyway,
yes.
More words that I hate.
Yes. But it's similar to, we had sparse sweet fruits, but then we discovered how to farm. We're still bound by the physical reality of, I can't turn the entire world into banana farms. We tried. It didn't work.
Yeah, they died.
They died. But in the space of information and content, you can't.
These are basically free. Yeah.
They're free. And not only that, but once modified, they can be freely distributed for the most part, and freely copied for the most part.
Right, there's a negligible cost to copying some information.
Right, but what
at least in the quantities that people care about.
Right, but what this ends up with is we can absolutely, for very very negligible costs, create content farms that will just pump out exactly what we want. And I think what we were kind of getting to earlier in the difference between the internet then, where someone created something because they wanted to see it there. Now there exists a demand, and not only a demand, but a very convenient mechanism for delivering that demand and distributing, connecting suppliers to consumers for the form of content being the web, that now even content being created by individuals is mostly being created to fit a demand, mm-hmm. not for personal gain, which brings out some interesting things. Any of those human desires you may have had before, now that you have a place to get them, there will that you then contribute to the demand, which will then ensure that someone else out there will create it and then slap some ads on it, and there you go. Everyone's
and now you have a business paid. Model. Yeah.
Yeah, everyone's getting paid. So it's like the candy bar or the sugary fruit problem, but it's anything. Anything that you can just watch. Which is a lot, because that's our primary way of getting information about our world is through our eyes.
For most of us, anyway.
For most of us, yeah. And people realize this because we are smart enough to create positive feedback loops. And by that, we mean loops that encourage the loop, not necessarily that they have a positive impact on the person in the loop.
Right.
But we're also smart enough to sometimes recognize the loop. That's, I think, the interesting thing is it's hard to see when you're in the loop sometimes.
But after you've been in it for a while, you might start to notice.
You start to notice. Or if someone kind of pokes you and says, hey, do you mean you notice you're in a loop? And then it clicks. It all makes sense. And I think what this piece of content did is poke enough people for them to realize they're in the loop. And now they want to talk about it. So one of the things that, you know, there is a growing discussion about the internet and is it good for us? When the internet first came about and for the first, you know, couple of decades of the web, you know, the concept of taking a holiday from the web was not something that people talked about.
Right.
No one said, oh, I'm going to leave my phone at home. I'm not going to buy a separate phone that doesn't have access to the web that only makes phone calls so that I can take it into the woods and stay in a cabin for a week to detox from the web. That was just not something that people did. That was because most people spent the minority of their time in the web and spent the majority of their time off of it. But now we're finding that people are spending even if not more time interfacing with the web than they are with reality, right? And this has some curious effects on our mental health, which is also a topic that everyone loves to talk about today in general. We'll talk more about that, I think, in a different episode because that's an interesting topic all by itself. But people are talking about, is the internet linked to attention deficit disorders, you know, ADHD? Is it, does it contribute to OCD because the internet can deliver things in exactly the way that you want so that you can, you know, you're not confronted with realities that don't necessarily conform to the, how you would like things to, but because you're, you know, and when you're in that kind of circumstance, when you're put into a reality that doesn't conform to your idea, you become tolerant of and can tolerate things that are outside of your expectations better. But if you
something we talked about on this show before is echo chambers, which are another type of positive feedback loop you can find on the web, where people of like mind get together and talk about the things they all agree on.
Right. And when you really boil it down, and I'm not a mental health expert, so do not take this as any form of advice. Seek professional help if you feel as though you need to, by a licensed whatever. But me outside looking in, and a lot of these cognitive, I'm going to make a key separation here, cognitive, not disabilities, but cognitive deficiencies or illnesses, they all kind of have to come, they all boil down to different ways in which your expectations are not met. And that's a very rough way of defining it, and that's not the technical definition, but you have an idea in your head of how things should be and want to be, or how things are, and then reality is not that. And when you're confronted with that, it causes you stress. It causes you negative emotion, which then impacts your life further in the form of anxiety or depression, right? Well, the internet is great at feeding you exactly what you expect. You, especially now, are constantly being monitored by algorithms whose entire job are to drip feed you things that you expect and throw in maybe a little bit of things that you don't expect, but you expect to not expect them. And that's a mouthful there, but it's true. There's this concept of the Skinner box, which exists, which if you want to go ahead and explain that.
The Skinner box. Okay. Named after psychologist B.F. Skinner, who was experimenting on birds. I forget exactly what types of birds. Anyway, put them into a box and gave them some sort of control,
like a button to press.
Conventionally, a button that, when pressed, would give them food, give them a little pellet of something to eat. Right, and so then they quickly learned that they very quickly made the association for button equals food, button right. yields food, and so they will compulsively push the button, and then this will also get to the point where even if you disconnect the button and remove the association, they will continue obsessively pushing it until food arrives somehow.
Right. And the way this manifests in our existing reality, this comes about in games a lot, especially games that are designed to be games, where you can press buttons and you get rewards, but they're artificial at first to get you to form that association. But then the button is actually hooked up to the real thing that gives the reward, and the reward's random. Really, to you, it's random, but you don't feel that way. It's pressing the button feels good still.
Yes.
As long as you're rewarded every now and again. And there's been interesting studies that show that if you want to reward someone for a certain type of behavior, it's actually better to reward them on random intervals than it is to do a scheduled reward system. Because if you do it randomly, they will not form a habit around the reward. They will always be expecting it.
If you give a reward once a day, they'll just pick a time of day to come claim the reward and then leave.
Right.
But if you make it random, they never know when it's going to happen.
They'll always be there.
Yeah.
Casinos function a lot like this.
Yes.
There's a lot of psychology into casinos that make them very effective at extracting money from wallets.
Yes.
But the internet's great at extracting your attention from everything else. So that's what these algorithms do. They do introduce a little bit of random every now and again, knowing that you're going to come back, and that random thing is not always so random. That's where conflicting interest can live. It can be half the algorithm thinking this is what you might find interesting based on other people with similar habits. Or I'm going to put that in a matrix with things that I want you to see to find the optimal thing that I can drip feed you that you expect, that you want recommended, but also I want you to see. And that's where this is coming from. So, but this is all still functions of our psychology at play. We're just designing algorithms and bots that fit our own psychology. And essentially, a lot of what the internet is a feedback loop. In its entirety.
That's what keeps you coming back.
Yeah. And it's a diversified feedback loop that fits almost any niche. Because if anything, the internet is anything but... It mainstreamed niches, if that makes any sense. Oh, well, I only like X brand apparel in black. There is a subreddit for that.
Sure.
There are vendors that only sell that. There are tons of communities of people that feel the exact same way.
I think my favorite example is like obscure music genres. Stuff that could never make it mainstream. Like, I have a friend who listens to pirate metal.
Yeah.
That would never make it on the radio if the radio were the primary way still of discovering new music. But on the internet, as soon as you learn that is a thing, you can easily find more of it.
Right. And this actually has an interesting parallel to more classic forms of media. So there is a genre of films called cult classics, mm-hmm. right? And there are films that flopped on release, generally speaking, and most people do not like them, but those who do really like them.
Yeah.
Yes. And they will buy the toys. They will buy the comic books. They will buy tickets to watch the people who acted the parts read their lines into a microphone. They love it so much. But it turns out that anything can be cult like that. And not only that, but there's also an interesting parallel when it comes to attractiveness I'm going to go ahead and dip into because I find this one personally fascinating. So in talking about mainstream versus like cult behavior, there was an interesting study done on dating websites where there are two interesting correlations that are formed. There's the number of ratings that a person can have. So the way they set this up is that there are two pools of people. There are the pools of people who are, you know, each pool is attracted to the other pool in some way, shape, or form. You know, I'm not going to get into all of the, you know, combinations of sexual preference here. That's not important. What's important is people in pool A are generally attracted or are attracted to people in pool B as a general rule. So they are going to flip through the people in pool B and apply a rating value for how attractive they find them. What they found is that there's a cluster of people that receive a lot of good reviews, sevens on average. Like, you were rated by a lot of people a seven. So there were a very few low numbers, but very few really high numbers. You were clustered right above middle. And, you know, there's human politeness to factor into that as to why it's not a five. Uh-huh. But there's also this group of people that have two clusters of groupings where mm-hmm. they're either rated very low, 0 to 3, or 8 to 10. So
the controversial ones.
Yes. The ones that people either, they really find you attractive or they don't.
Yeah.
Or they find you repulsive. And there really isn't a gradient between the two. You're either a person that will turn off most, but be really attractive to a minority, or you will be moderately attractive to most people.
Yeah.
Those are your options. And there are very, very few people that fall into the category of everyone hates you, you know what I mean? Or everyone finds you stunningly attractive except for a handful of people. Those don't exist. So what the internet is, and what's even more interesting is when you look at the breakdown of how people voted, everyone who would put in the 7 category for the, you know, a handful of these people had a much more diverse portfolio of a handful of people that they rated even higher than that, but then a different group that they rated much, much lower. But what the internet allows us to do is select for the tens. Even if most people would rate them a 0, you know, let's take, for example, pirate metal. Some people rate that music a 10, but not enough people that a record label is going to sign a pirate metal band and put them on tour because they won't make enough money.
Right.
Right. They're looking for 7s. Classic media formats look for 7s. I want to find movies, bands, books, authors that can crank me out 7s.
Yeah. I don't want something controversial. I want mass appeal. That's right. What you're going for if you're, yeah.
But the internet is looking for the 10s because guess what? It doesn't cost me anything. It costs me the same to put out a 7 that it does to put out a 10. But I would much rather have 10s in my Skinner box than 7s. Because 7s change with the wind. That's the other thing that happens. People who liked the, you know, Jurassic Park back in 1993 when it came out, that was a 7 movie. It was a great movie. But those people didn't buy the Jurassic Park merch. They went on to the next big film that came out, that the next summer blockbuster, who cares? But the people who watched Blade Runner, the handful who loved it, they went to everything Blade Runner, right? So this is just an example of a co-classic versus mainstream.
Yeah.
When the cost of delivery is the same, you're going to hyper-optimize for the 10 because it doesn't matter. I can easily put that out. So in a weird way, cult classics or culty behavior is becoming the mainstream because that's what we want. But what that also does is kind of silo people off by their preferences, which is where you get those echo chambers from. But I guess what's the point in all this? Like, what are we talking about, I guess? Because we're really running up the time. It's just fascinating to talk about. But this is fundamentally different because the reason classical media did what it did didn't just have to do with the cost necessarily of putting things out. It's that human interactions and what you felt like was your favorite or what you liked, the reason it tended to cluster around an average is because that's where people interfaced, IRL, you know, in real life. You formed a lot of what you found attractive based on what the guy sitting next to you in your first grade classroom, whatever hottie was on the poster in his bedroom, right? You may not have particularly found that lady a 10 or that dude a 10, you know, but because your friend thought so, you kind of thought so too, right? When you're forming opinions, it's amazing how your opinions are really subjective and circumstantial.
Yeah.
Not always, but a lot of the times they are.
Especially when you're younger.
Especially when you're younger, when you're forming those opinions for the first time. Until you have something to stick to, you'll stick to anything.
Yeah.
But now the internet gives you the thing you want to stick to. And I guess the tagline of all this is that it's not a concerted effort by a select few that did this. It's what we would have done if we could have delivered everything for as cheap as we could have in the past. It is just our behavior in an environment where we can optimize where we couldn't before, you know?
Right.
And that's not necessarily a negative thing because you can build some amazing feedback loops in this new system. Today, current year, where the price of education is one of the things that's talked about the most, where everyone talks about having a good education is critical to your success, regardless of whether that's true or not.
You can educate yourself for free.
You can educate yourself for free. You can get a better education than you could get at any university if you wanted to. If you optimized for it, the system exists, but we don't.
Necessarily. I don't know that that's always true. It depends on that. That's going to be largely dependent on the field. And I disagree that you can get a better education than you can get at any university, depending on your field. There is a place for truly good teachers.
True.
That can do a better job of teaching you than you could do yourself just looking at the material.
But what I'm saying is, but we're running against the resource problem again. The best teachers are tutors, I would assert. The best teachers, from the perspective of the student, not necessarily from the perspective of the teacher society, but if you wanted to give a person the best education, I would say that the best way to do that is to give that person, that teacher's full attention and time.
Sure.
Right? On any subject that they needed to pursue. And then, granted, the place for teachers...
But even with the fact that that is diluted by other students in the classroom, there are some professors who are so good at teaching that even though their attention is diluted amongst, you know, let's say maybe 30 people in the classroom or more in a big university, that still it is better than what you could get just looking on the internet at the material.
For now. Okay. Maybe I'd made a bold statement there that's too blanketed. But I'm going to also lean on CGP Grey's Digital Aristotle video, where he talks about how algorithms can be used to educate better than a teacher ever could. Because that algorithm can understand a student better than a human being ever could.
Yeah.
And that already... The things that can facilitate that algorithm already exist. The hard part is you not knowing what you need to know to not know anymore. And you maybe not knowing the best way to digest something to learn it, right? Like,
right.
We don't always know the best way for ourselves to learn. I'm going to take a quick... I don't care if we go over time at this
point.
Sure,
this is fine.
I'm going to take a brief pet peeve moment here.
Okay.
I hate when people tell me that I'm an ex-learner.
Like, I'm a visual learner.
Okay. Yeah. Or the one that I actually hate the most is I am a hands-on learner.
Okay.
Okay, sure.
Everyone is a hands-on learner.
Sure you are. Yeah, that's the thing that pisses me off a lot, because I'm like, how do you know? Have you actually sat down and tried to learn this? How do you test that? Because maybe you learn different things, different ways better. Tell about that. Or maybe there's certain types of concepts that are easier for you to digest in a visual format than they would be in a hands-on format, because they're abstract and you can't put a hands-on format. It'll actually narrow the vision of what you're trying to learn. And not only that, but it's like, are you really...
Well, yeah, like try, like, okay, this is something that you can learn in a hands-on way. But I feel like it would be cumbersome. Like, I'm thinking about things like circuit design.
Yeah.
Like, okay. If I wanted to teach you Kirchhoff's voltage law, what's going to be easier? Me drawing a diagram about how this thing is going to work, or actually having to build a parallel circuit and say, look, now if we change these resistors around and take our little ammeter and hold it up here, or the voltmeter or whatever, you know, look, then you can see the number. Like, what's the difference? Did you really have to do that with your hands?
No.
Or could I have just drawn it for you?
Being someone who's had that education both ways, yeah. Let me tell you, they're both inferior to someone building a bunch of pipes, clear pipes with colored water in them. That's actually the best way to learn that subject. And that can be both visual or hands-on. You don't actually have to build the pipe, because actually hands-on's worse, because you're learning plumbing, which is not at all what you need to learn to assemble this thing hands-on.
Yeah.
But what you really need is to watch the fluid flow through these pipes and watch how the speed of the fluid drops.
And of course, now we can do this with computer diagrams, too, that actually have moving diagrams. It's better than a plain old drawing.
Absolutely. To me, it's the hubris to say that you are so meta-aware of yourself that you know best.
That you... Yeah. Very few people actually understand their own psychology.
Yeah. Even me. Like,
Yeah, I'm not claiming to be special either.
No.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way. If you have a moment where you realize all of a sudden, like watching this Bo Burnham video or something you watch on YouTube or someone just saying something to you, if you realize, wait, I'm in a loop, you don't know yourself that well. Because if you really knew yourself that well, you would have known before, you would have saw the loop before you got there.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have put yourself in it. If you have any problem that you wish you didn't have, guess what? If you knew your psychology well enough,
you wouldn't have put yourself,
you wouldn't have put yourself in that situation. Yep. Yeah. You wouldn't be obese right now. You would have chosen better foods to eat 4 or 5 years ago. If you wanted to be a buff, you know, beefcake, guess what? You would have been in the gym 4 or 5 years ago. so that you would be that way today. You know what I mean? So don't tell me you know yourself better, you know, because if you
if you did know yourself better, you would be achieving your goals.
Absolutely. Yeah. You could have mastered your psychology, if you will. I hate that phrase as well. Master your psychology, because there's too many woo books written about that. But
oh, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, they exist. Trust
me. Well, I know that books about that kind of thing exist, but.
Right. If you've ever struggled with any kind of addiction, guess what? That's your psychology at play that you could have easily avoided, but you didn't. Like, and I'm not trying to, like, crap on you here. I'm not trying to make you feel bad, okay? Because I know that's bad for engagement, and I really want this content to sell well. But I'm going to tell you like it is because, yeah, we are all that way. And if we could be the masters of our psychology, the world would be a much different place.
Right, yeah. Think of how many people get themselves into traps, either be that with chemical addictions or...
Relationships.
Oh, goodness.
The other big one that everyone's always...
That's a big
one.
I was also thinking financial traps. People get themselves stuck in debt because they don't understand themselves well enough to not get themselves stuck in a trap.
Right.
Yeah, if you understood yourself, you wouldn't be paying off, you know, unnecessary loans.
Or you would have known that risk going in, and you would have known this...
Right, you wouldn't be kicking yourself for being in debt because you would have anticipated it.
Yeah, You would actually probably be pretty happy with yourself if you were aware of your psychology, because then you could take risks that you acknowledge were risks and also know exactly how you would feel when it wouldn't work out and make sure that you never walk against that threshold.
Right.
But that's the point I'm saying is that the internet is this. It is these loops. It is nothing but a loop factory made by people for people to get them trapped into loops.
And make you feel good.
And make you feel good. Because,
which, by the way, making you feel good might not be... as straightforward as you think. See CGP Gear's video called "This Video Will Make You Angry."
Right. And it will make you feel good in the most efficient short-term way possible. Enough to keep you coming back. Because that's the things that are easy to make.
Have you ever I know you surely have, but to the listeners, consider, have you ever been on the web somewhere, maybe Reddit, maybe YouTube, whatever, didn't see anything you wanted to see, closed it, and moments later reopened it thinking that you were going to see something different?
I have absolutely been on YouTube and hit the YouTube logo to refresh the page waiting for something new to come up, like, just to see if I could get something.
Well, not
new.
Just that, but like, actually close the tab or whatever, or the app, depending on how you're watching, close it because you're like, okay, I'm done. What should I do? Yes, YouTube. You go right back to where you were.
Yep.
That's you being in the loop.
Yep.
You are in the loop.
If you lock your phone and immediately unlock it, swipe up, and go back to that app and reopen it.
You're in the loop.
Yeah. The most common one I've seen other people do, and this is going to be totally unique to me, is social media is like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like Twitter, Instagram. They will get on, and also infinite scrolling. Isn't that a wonderful thing that they was invented?
No. I hate it.
Yeah, remember when pagination was a thing that was obvious?
Yes.
For those of you who don't know, pagination just means we're chopping this into pages.
Yes.
Yeah, see? And don't get me wrong, infinite scrolling works that way. If you have a free scrolling wheel mouse, you will find out very quickly that it's still paginating. It's just not showing you
pages.
Yeah,
it's just pulling it. Yeah. It pulls the next page. It tries to pull the next page before you reach the bottom of the current page.
And it appends it to the bottom. Yeah. Yeah, the invention of the infinite scroll is a great example of we don't even care anymore. We don't want to give clean exit spots.
Yeah, because when you so I still use the old Reddit interface that is that does not have the infinite scroll interface. I get 25 links per page, and so yeah, that gives me a clean jumping off point. It's like, okay, I need to get something done. I'll wait till I get to the bottom of this page, and then I'm done.
Yep.
But if there is no bottom, then you have to decide when to stop.
Or...
and you won't want to stop.
You get tired.
Sure, yeah. Eventually other things will creep in. You get tired, you get hungry, whatever.
Right. But I think that tiredness goes away very fast, which is where you get the close it, return to steady state, and when you're... the event loop of your head wraps back around to, what should I do?
I'm bored. Oh. What can I do for fun? Ooh, Reddit.
Yeah. absolutely. And that's an interesting concept because... Extra Credits did a... back when Extra Credits was good. That's my opinion. I was not going to say it, but I'm saying it. It's
better. Sure, we don't need to rant about Extra Credits. Yeah. Anyway.
But they did an interesting talk about game design concerning exit loops, which are exit points. Mm-hmm. And they asserted that any good game has clean exit points, because if you're designing a game, you don't want the player to be burned out. Because burnout, a player walking away from your game with a negative outcome is less likely to return to the game.
Yeah.
Right? And the way you exacerbate a negative outcome is to extend it. So say a person is losing. They keep getting beat. They keep getting beat. They keep getting beat. They keep losing. They keep losing. They keep losing. And they keep going back to that same save point. Losing, 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 losing. And finally, they rage quit. If you rage quit off of a game, you're more likely to just immediately uninstall it or never pick it back up again.
Yeah.
But if you put a loop in where, oh, I got to the end of a checkpoint. Okay, I can just stop here. You know, oh, it's... How many times have you done this? Oh, man, it is 12... It is 11:45 p.m. I need to hit the next save and log off because I'm trying to be in bed by midnight. If the game has a convenient stopping place and it's just after 12, you'll get off. But if the game doesn't have a convenient stopping place, you look back and it's 1 a.m. because you feel bad leaving something unfinished. Or at least I do.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people have that notion of we want closure, I guess, it's a very watered down form of closure, but like,
right. When you finish doing something, you want to feel like you have accomplished something.
Right.
Yeah. If there's not a clean, stopping point, you don't really feel like you've accomplished something. You just feel like you stopped doing something.
Right. That opens up one last point I want to make. So one other part of the special that he talks about is that he started doing this project because he was in isolation due to, a pandemic. Yeah. I'm going to phrase it that way because in perpetuity, he was in isolation due to a pandemic. So he started this project and he found that he felt better working than he did not working. Not a revolutionary thing that, but the closer he got to completion, he started getting anxiety again, but it was anxiety about not working anymore. Because that's the downside to closure is when you finish something. And I've experienced this when I finished a game, when I'm finished with a book, I'm finished with a TV show. Not so much a movie because it's small enough that I can...
Right, you're ready for the movie to end. Yeah.
But something that I've had a lot of investment in, and like the longer you've been working in something, there's this weird notion that you don't want it to end. And I feel like...
Yeah, it's become part of your life.
Yeah, and I feel like that's also a component of the internet or the web.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want it to end, and it's not like it will, like there's a
the internet's not going to end. No,
but when you've watched through that a whole YouTube catalog, when you've watched through that creator's entire backlog of content,
I want more.
You want more.
CGP Grey, please.
Exactly. But you would feel bad if you got that video of this is my last video.
Oh, yeah, that is the worst. Isn't and I it? Have experienced that a few times of, yeah, putting up the video that says, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm doing other things in my life now.
Yep. And it's totally not incumbent on me to demand anyone keep
making. No, I can't tell someone.
No.
Yeah. You can't stop. You owe me. You owe me more video. No, you don't. It's your life. You can do what you want.
Right.
But I'm still disappointed that there will be no more. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I do think... We're at this weird point where, like, I'm going to take the infinite scroll example from before. We like knowing that I can keep scrolling forever. There's a comfort in knowing that, oh, there's still more to look at. You know, there's still more to engage with, if you will, all the terms. So I can log off. And so you log off. And then you immediately get back on because there's more to look at. It's a weird catch-22 where because it's infinite, you feel good. Resigning yourself to knowing that you'll never finish it because it's impossible. There's more content.
It's truly impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if there was only 10 people making content for the internet part time, so half of their day, so 4 hours a day, they would still be generating more content than you could consume because it's being generated at a faster rate than you can consume it. But now, even if you only want to consume one infinitesimal percentage of all the content that's being put out, that's still being created faster than you could ever consume it.
Yeah. The last that I heard, and this has been years ago now that I heard this figure, so who knows how it's changed now, but 72 hours of video were being uploaded to YouTube every minute.
Yeah. I'm actually going to look it up because I'm curious to see what it is.
Yeah. So like, but even with that outdated number at this point, that is insane. And goes to show how just how impossible it will be for you to finish the internet. That's just YouTube. What do we have?
In 2019, there are 500 hours every minute. Daily.
YouTube. Yeah, 500 hours every minute worldwide. Yep. So there we go. 500 now, up from 72 whenever I looked at that.
Yep. So, yep. That's pretty daunting when you think about it.
Yeah, let's see. That's over 20 days of video. Almost 21 days. Almost 3 weeks of video every minute.
Yeah. So that's more content than you could consume in a year and a day if you never slept.
Yeah. So you're not finishing it.
Yeah. The lifetime, your lifetime of content consumable could be.
Although it is interesting that despite that incomprehensibly huge figure,
there's still nothing good to watch.
There's still nothing good to watch. You can very quickly exhaust what you are interested in seeing on YouTube.
That you know of.
That's also true.
And that's the current optimization problem. Matching you
with things that you don't know exist that you would enjoy.
Yes.
Yeah. Imagine trying to filter through 500 hours of video uploaded every minute. And then your job is to find the 6 videos that this person would like to watch out of that.
Yep.
To show on their front page or whatever.
Yep.
However many videos you see on the front page now. Doesn't matter. Yep. Right.
So yeah.
One more thing about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
We talked about this a little bit before the show, that one of the things to be concerned about with the positive feedback loop of internet content is vicarious living.
Mm.
Vicarious living and feeling like you make a difference. When you watch things or read about people doing things on the internet, there is a tendency to feel like you are a part of what's happening. This is especially the case with stuff like live streaming, where you feel like you have a personal connection with whoever is doing the stream. But it can also happen for videos and articles and stuff like that too. But you have to watch out for feeling like you are making a difference. You can really, feel proud of yourself for participating in stuff like change.org, which does nothing, by the way, but where you sign petitions and feel like you're making a difference. You're not making a difference. You are sitting on your rear end in front of a computer screen doing nothing while feeling like you are accomplishing something with your life. I think that's the truly dangerous thing about feedback loops like this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that they can get you to feel as if you're doing something when you are not. And the implications of this is that it allows people who actually do things to get an advantage over you.
I'm going to cite a thing that happened. Kony 2012, one like equals one child. the term slacktivism was coined in that time. And that is human attention that could have actually been used to make a positive impact on the world was actually wasted on liking Facebook comments. But yeah, it's you can feel more engaged with your world, with the world. I said your world because that's what it really is, but the world, than ever before. You can feel like you're making bigger impacts than you ever have before, while also making no impact or much less.
Less impact than you would have by going to your day job.
Right, and that is dangerous. One, it's dangerous for you because, especially when you come up against something that you can't change. A good example is during the 2016 presidential election and that cycle. I'm just going to leave it at that. It was really shown exactly how much power social media had over company investment and company behavior. So massive billion-dollar companies could actually be swayed to do things based on a loud, very small minority of people. But they were loud, right? But like most things, fool me once, you know. But we're seeing now that a lot of that doesn't translate into reality. And so there's a correction coming, which is big, because big companies hate negative PR, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what way to feel like you have the worst PR than to be barraged on Twitter all day by angry people, which is where you go to be angry on the internet, by the way. But 1,000 angry Twitter users that don't even buy your product
do not matter to you.
Do not matter. And companies are starting to realize it. So I think one of the good things that's going to come out about all of this is that we will quickly correct the realistic input to be what it actually is in real, you know, and that is that no one's opinions are being swayed on what products to buy on Twitter by some other Twitter user. Like, no one's going to not buy something all of a sudden because someone else on Twitter is mad about something they did. Just to quote CGP Grey for the third and final time this video, I hope, he talked about in his video on humans need not apply, you know, he's like, your barista might make your double mocha, whatever, just right, but millions of people don't care.
Yep.
And that's true. So not just for your sake, but for keeping in mind that if you could measure like the charitability index of the world and what impact charity does have, and I mean that in like volunteering time and money, I would imagine that people who like one like equals one child save don't feel like they need to donate money anymore.
Right.
They don't need to volunteer, you know? But people who...
I've done my good quota for today by pushing a button on a webpage.
Right.
That cost me nothing.
And the correction will come when the things you care about, when enough people start doing that, the things you care about stop changing. There will always be one more child to save, which, don't get me wrong, that's kind of also the nature of reality, as it is anyway. But when we start seeing people making real changes that actually affect the real world, then people will opt, I think, for those methods of making those making that happen, which is, again, money, resources, time. Like, that's what they need to make those things happen. And there's upsides to this, too. Kickstarters are great examples. For every 100 failed Kickstarts, there's one company that actually got going, that actually delivered a product that would not have existed because no marketing company would have ever said this was a good idea. No investor would have ever put the money behind. So there are upsides to this, but I think as we optimize those, we'll, you know, it'll get better. It's just for you as well, like in your personal life, if you truly do want to make a difference, nothing would compare to actually doing it with your hands or with your money, which you made with your hands, probably, or the euphemism, or the not euphemism, but the metaphor.
Yes.
Yeah, internet's a great place. It's wonderful. It's everything that we made it to be, we being all of us. So, I don't know. This has been a very long topic, and I'm okay with that.
Sure.
But, it's also much like the internet, endless. Examples abound. We could go on for forever, but I'm glad we at least put a dent in it for today. So I don't have anything else.
Neither do I.
Philosophers.
If you like the music in this episode, please check out Jippy on Bandcamp at jippy.bandcamp.com.
Philosophers is supported by viewers like you.
If there's a topic you'd like us to discuss,
or a topic you'd like to see revisited in the future,
please let us know by contacting us using the methods in the description,
or in the comments below. Thank you for listening.